the point of having a factor is to be different than the index. Multi-factor, you combine six factors and then all of a sudden you're back to what the S&P 500 holds.
This is the ETF Experience Podcast, brought to you by the team at Exponential ETFs. We'll take you behind the scenes of the asset management industry while talking investing, trading, best practices, and how to build better portfolios. Here's your host, Phil Bock.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the ETF Experience Podcast. We've got a very special episode with me. First off, Sam, I want to apologize and thank you for your patience. A little bit of technical difficulties here, but we are going and we're back recording in Detroit. And with me today is Sam Husko, founder, CEO, CIO, investment advisor, and every other role at SGH Wealth Management, or every other role of note.
Yep. We're going in a firm approach now, so we've got four employees at this point, so we're definitely kind of expanding, but still at this stage of things, wearing a lot of hats, so yep.
Well, Sam, thanks for coming down. Thanks for joining. So we had an interesting conversation a couple of weeks ago, and you talk about being an investment advisor and managing the investment side of the business, and then you talk about the other aspects of the business, which are more management in nature, and you're doing HR, and you're growing the business in different ways. Tell me about how you got started and what area of the business you feel is like your sweet spot and the part that you really love to do, and then the challenges about going solo and how that all kind of evolved over time.
Yeah. So I went to U of M, thought I was going to work for the Bureau of Labor Statistics, got a job in DC, and then my would-be boss got fired about a month before I was set to move out to DC, and they reopened the interview process, so I kind of just stumbled into this industry, but started right off the bat at a commission brokerage firm. So got my Series 7, went that approach, and learned fairly quickly that that didn't suit me at all. I found the relationships transient. It was very sales-driven. And I enjoy sales, but not the relationships that I was wanting to build. So then at the ripe age of 25, I went independent. So I would attribute that to just not knowing the risks that I was walking into more than a calculated decision. But yeah, I mean, we really built our practice off of General Motors employees. Federal Mogul is also another company that we've targeted and got a lot of people from as well, too. And today where we've refined things, though, is we find that there's a sweet spot in the market for us in clients that have somewhere between 500,000 to 5 million in assets. That area today is still really being targeted by mutual fund salesmen. And so from a fee approach, we are really different from that model. And also having direct access to the actual financial analyst. A lot of advisors out there are purchasing a mutual fund for their clients. So they're kind of a middleman to the process, whereas our clients work as a fiduciary duty, independent. So they're getting that direct access as well, too.
Having been in the Detroit area all this time and having been independent and working directly with people who work at General Motors and at some of the different car companies, there have been so many ups and downs over the last 10, 15 years since you've been independent. How do you feel about the Detroit area? It's such a riveting story, certainly to me as an outsider now being a part of it and being down here. I really love everything about Detroit, and it's just such a great energy, but you've seen it go through some hard times. So what are you seeing?
One thing about being 37 and in this industry is I've been in it long enough to be through 2008, which is actually more unique now that we're hiring people. A lot of people don't have that experience of going through a downturn. But with that too, we had to advise people on really difficult decisions through that 2008 zone. And should they keep their GM bonds? Should they keep their GM stock, et cetera, when the bankruptcies were occurring? So we've been through that low. We've certainly seen the resurgence. It's impossible not to recognize what's going on nowadays. Like you said, just the energy downtown and kind of going from there. And recently, with the big GM layoffs, severances, whatever you want to call them, back in December, we got interest from CNBC to be quoted because we just had so many clients at GM. And in that experience, we've now seen almost all of our clients get jobs within 4 months of that instance. So more so than anything, that's shown me the strength of this area is people can get to work, there's jobs available, and something as massive as what's happening with the auto industry and the layoffs today, everybody's finding a way to get back to work. So that's been really encouraging for the strength of this area. So
it's great to see. And I think that when I first came down here, I certainly didn't see for a while, and that I didn't expect to see is the amount of startups. There's a whole fintech community and there's people doing all sorts of things down here. For me being in finance, it's fun. There's real buzz and excitement. So being a young advisor, it's a funny thing. So you're 37. I say in this industry, anyone under 55 might be considered a young advisor. Right. It tends to be an older demographic. But in terms of modernizing the practice, and I think your practice is very modern. You utilize a lot of really good data. You use ETFs primarily, factor investing. Tell me about how that works, the process of modernizing it, and how that differentiates you from some of the more entrenched advisors.
Yeah, I learned from what I consider to be the best sales type of people in the finance industry. Because you go in the commission side and you're selling a product that might have some issues with it. Learning how they went about that process was really valuable for me. However, I think it's hard to teach an old dog new tricks in certain senses. What's worked for an advisor from a sales perspective and from a business perspective for the last 25 years, it's going to be hard to convince them that they need to change their model altogether and go in a completely different direction than before. So by taking some of those aspects, what I really feel like clients are paying for when they're working with us is more so us constantly evaluating the next investments to come. I don't believe the finance industry innovates a whole lot, but we might have three phenomenal innovations over a decade, but we're selling 30 new investments a week. So it's saying no a lot and getting into the right things that fit our certain metrics. How we go about it is more on the macro level to analyze the markets, analyze sectors, et cetera. And then we do choose factors within that model to fit what our overall market outlook is. And so the CFA background is really the first step of analyzing the markets. And then we just choose the tools. And where ETFs are just a phenomenal invention, and I'd consider them one of those three that have really innovated, is that they're diversified, they're cheap, and they allow you to be different than the index. One thing that I constantly criticize is you own a large cap mutual fund and chances are you're owning the exact same stocks as the index anyways. So if you're looking to be active, you have to be different. And then the other thing, which has taken me a while to get towards, but cost is a big, big factor in performance. It's the highest correlated item in long-term returns. And so if we're not fighting that battle for clients over the long term, I think we're going to lose right off the bat. So it really fits all those areas. And there was a planning profession fee survey from Inside Information. And even on the RIA side of things, which I do think is the more transparent, ethical side of the industry, on average, RIAs are charging 1.8% a year.
1.8.
Huh. So for us to be able to come in and with ETFs maybe be in the range of 1.1 to 0.7, I'm all for these older advisors not changing their direction because it's been fairly easy to take over business right now. And so whereas there might be fears of the future of the industry, until all the advisors kind of get towards that fee compression direction, we're having opportunity and growing very fast because of it. So,
and that's great. So you wrote a post for ETF.com where you talked about multi-factor versus single factor. And I really liked it. All of our proprietary funds are single factor. I like multi-factor. I always kind of felt like, well, multi-factor should be assembled at the portfolio level. So you, the advisor, the allocator say, all right, I want to mix and match with these tools and use them and assemble them, as opposed to a multi-factor where everything's all kind of commingled together and then you have a little less flexibility to tilt towards one factor or the other. You talked a little bit about that in your post, but you really went on and gave, I thought, a really good case for a single factor, multi-factor. Can you sum up the post for our listeners?
Yeah. So in the long-winded version of it is, I still believe most financial advisors are unqualified to be investors. To get your Series 7, which is the licensing to trade, it doesn't even require a high school diploma, as far as I know. And so you could have somebody in the CFA advertisement of the DJ becoming the advisor in the booth or what have you is a great example of it. But this is a trust-based business, and a lot of people don't have the background to do that. And so I feel like the multi-factor approach has tried to be this autopilot version to replace mutual funds. And it's for these advisors that probably aren't qualified to do money management themselves, but recognize there is fee compression. And so they have to go in that direction themselves as well too. I also find more in the multi-factor world than other, you find empirical evidence, and I'm putting air quotes in. That term is losing some credibility because they're data mining, in my opinion, a lot more than other areas as well too. So there's no easy button for this. There's no way to make this plug and play. It takes management if you're going to be in the ETF space, in my opinion. So that's where I think it's propagating itself as something that's easy very simple to manage, no effort involved. And in reality, I think over the future timeframe, they're going to underperform to a certain degree. And what I was saying in that ETF.com article the most is just the point of having a factor is to be different than the index. Multi-factor, you combine six factors and then all of a sudden you're back to what the S&P 500 holds. And so if you're in a goal to try to be active and try to take advantage of the market when those opportunities exist, you have to be different than the market. And by having a multi-factor approach, I think it defeats the purpose. So,
yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it's kind of like you take a deck of cards and say, all right, I'm going to split them out into the four suites and then put them back together. You end up right back where you started. A lot of the multi-factor funds look really more like equal weight than they do market cap weight. I love the equal weight strategy. I mean, I've always said that the whole genesis of our reverse cap fund was trying to figure out how do we take that equal weight premium, equal weight over market cap weight, and extrapolate that out further or give people more of that. I think equal is a great strategy, but yeah, you look at some of the multi-factor funds, you look at the weighted average market cap is going to be a lot closer to equal, but then when you take value and growth, they're the other side, they're the opposite ends of the same spectrum, you end up right back in the middle. And the same thing with quality and momentum. And it is a little bit self-defeating. And then you end up with a very small, it's almost like a screen out of a very few select set of funds of underlying securities. And if you accept, which not everyone does, but I do, and I'm curious your take on this, but if you accept that market cap weighting is itself a factor, then those few stocks that have been screened out, it's like, well, those are also a factor of market cap weight, which, by the way, has dominated in 2017, 2018. I don't expect it to in the future, but it could. So you're kind of like, all right, multi-factor, you're basically every factor but one, which is the market cap weight.
Right. And then also, too, the expense ratio of multi-factors are generally higher than something as simple as equal weight. So it's the sales side of our industry, I would say, again. They're trying to have a more compelling storyline, which is really important when you're presenting to a client and convincing them to get in your investment style than another, but it gets away from the core tenets of what really works long term. So
do you believe that factors as a framework and looking at stocks through the lens of factors, do you believe that that's replacing capital asset pricing model or traditional security valuation models?
I don't. I believe that you have to utilize every tool available to you. So if there's technical factors, if there's psychological factors, if being a history buff helps you out in making decisions in the beginning or in the future, all those things together is what should get you to come to a conclusion. With that, depending on where all these ideas come from is really going to help you come to that conclusion. So I've been a big fan lately of William Bernstein. I've been reading his books and just honestly became aware of him in the last year. And his four pillars of investing are theory, history, psychology, and business. And I would say with the CFA background, it's a theory ad nauseum. So there's no more theory than you would need than that programming. But really the history and psychological aspects of investing are what I actually find the most intriguing today. I would say that if there wasn't this emotional, psychological aspect of investing, a computer would be better at my job than me. But because that exists, those are the areas where we can blend everything together to really understand where the best places in the market should be.
So as a proponent of single factors, what are those single factors that you tend to gravitate towards?
Today, we're a big follower of forward priced earnings ratios. So we're starting to see the markets maybe slightly overvalued. Political concerns are obviously something that every investor has to confront right now as well. So we like the low volatility factor at the moment. With that, the reason I like low vol over minimum vol is that there's no constraints to the sectors. So low vol can have 0% in a sector, whereas min vol has, I believe, a plus minus 5% constrained sector weighting. So min vol will get you closer to the index, less tracking error, less risk involved with that too. But low vol is what's going to really do to a more extreme what we're looking for in these type of market environments. But the core of our business is still going to be based on long-term investing. So we utilize S&P indexes, equal weight indexes, et cetera. But the light risk mitigation that we do within the portfolio, we look for that factor that we feel like suits the market conditions the most. And today it's low vol.
What about fixed income? Do you use factors at all in fixed income? Do you think that factors are appropriate in fixed income?
Yeah, I mean, I want to come to that conclusion. Right now, I would say the large cap U.S., we're efficient market believers. So the large cap U.S. market's an efficient market. And so being a efficient market, I believe factors can have a role in that area. I think that the fixed income space is less traded. There's less eyes on it. And so I do think an analyst can be a little bit more dangerous in that world than so much competition in the large cap space. The other factor too is that bond mutual fund managers can't charge as much as equity. So the fee difference isn't as vast as, say, the stock space or what have you too. So finding a good analyst at a cheap price, I think, is easier in the fixed income space. But what we've actually been getting into lately are target maturity date ETFs. And what I really like about those is that, again, puts the onus on us to be able to create that portfolio for clients as opposed to something more automated with a factor. So we can control the duration completely. These ETFs mature in the year, so they get their principal back after the maturity date as well too. And it allows us to do a laddered approach, which is very similar to what we'd like to do if we were in individual securities, but in an ETF form. So that's our approach at this point. I think there's obviously room for active in the ETF fixed income space, but it hasn't been as comfortable for us yet to dive into that area. So
you referenced a couple of times the CFA designation. The CFA, anyone who's listening, I'm sure, is familiar with it. The massive effort that it takes and the pressure, except for level one, which is twice a year, but levels two and three, you have your one shot a year. And if you don't get a good night's sleep the night before, which most people don't, you're at risk of all that work going to nothing. It is a massive undertaking. I did level one, then I got sidetracked with the Kaya because I was working on some alternatives at a previous shop. I did Kaya one, Kaya 2, went back to CFA 2, and by that point I had my third child, and
okay.
it was just too hard to get back, but I will get back to it. And like you say, even after I retire, even if, you know, I will get it because I'm just that type where when I start something, I have to finish it. Charles, of course, is a CFA, and we have an analyst, Sal Duan, who's on level 3 in June.
Awesome.
So she's losing some sleep now and getting ready for that. But not only do you have the CFA, you're also the head of the CFA Society of Detroit.
Yep.
So what does a chapter head do? What is that involved? And
I've really tied myself to the CFA completely. So I was on the board of the Detroit chapter for 8 years. I was a president. I'm currently the university outreach chair, and I'm also the Midwest regional ethics presenter for the CFA Institute, all culminating in winning the 2017 International CFA Institute Volunteer of the Year Award. So that's a huge feather in my cap. Probably not as recognized in the Midwest, certainly flying me out to Hong Kong for the award and everything like that. It was a great honor. It is a bear. I had to study for 8 months every year for 3 years to have a shot to get through it. That's what it took from me. But I will say that and committing to volunteerism has been the catapult of my career. It just opened up so many doors for us. Even from a business sense, being a more rare find for a client to find a CFA to work with has been really valuable. I don't know as much about the Kaya. I'm also a CFP, but I always do a talk for the universities, and there's roughly about 18,000 CFPs in the state of Michigan alone. In the member base of the CFA Detroit, we had 480 members. And so not most of those people are financial planners. So it really reduces me down to a harder to match type of skill set. Back to running it. Honestly, running the CFA was event planning, sponsorship outreach, business networking, university partnerships. One task I had to do was investigate local CFA ethics violations.
Ooh, so that's got to be hairy.
So if the Institute got some complaints, we would have to dig around and see if those were legitimate. And then the biggest thing about the CFA that's frustrating is public awareness. So that was the thing that I was really trying the most. In New York, Chicago, et cetera, Boston, it's very well known. And in Detroit, it's not. So just trying to get the message out there more than anything. So
you mentioned that it's an advantage when dealing with clients. And of course it is. But in order for it to be, the clients have to know the difference. They have to know the difference between CFA and there's so many other designations or just somebody who has a university degree in finance, which,
yep.
Do you find that people know the difference? Do you find that?
No, I don't. That's my biggest frustration. The CFA, where I see the principal difference between that, an MBA, CPA, Kaya, et cetera, well, I'm not as familiar with Kaya, but the CFA ethics requirement is legitimate. They take away people's charters. And with that, to ruin 3 years of your life to try to make a quick buck, it's just not worth it to many CFAs. And so that's what I think really differentiates. The CFP's fiduciary duty, in my opinion, is too light. There's loopholes galore in that one.
The Kaya is great, by the way. So the Kaya is a lot of fun. It focuses on alternatives. It's more alternative strategies and alternative asset classes. But they do a couple things a little bit differently. They have one section that's called current and integrated topics. So there'll be things like white papers on why long-term capital failed or how to manage contango and other topics that I thought were, it was a lot less dry than I thought the CFA was. Certainly. The other thing is on each year, on each Kaya exam, they have a different focus and they do a very deep dive on one strategy. The year I did it was convertible bond arbitrage and you had to manually calculate during the exam the convertible bond arbitrage payoff. So it was more interesting. And they are, by the way, doing, they just instituted this, I don't know if it's temporary or permanent, but they just instituted something where if you have CFA, you can use that in lieu of or bypass Kaya level one. So you just jump to level two. I don't know if you've got the time. I know you've
I've got kids. Four kids as well. So yes, I'm not sure.
I found it to be more engaging just on the quality of content, more interesting. So, all right, let's talk about being an RIA.
Okay.
So you're dealing with clients. We deal primarily with financial advisors like yourself. We don't really deal with end clients. When you have clients coming in and some of them think they know everything about investing and they don't, and some of them know nothing and you really need to hold their hands, what's easier? What's better for you to work with? And how do you handle those difficult clients?
We pride ourselves in being as transparent as possible. So we have no problems giving a client what we bring to the table and not being all things to all people. So we don't work as well with the people that are trying to get a 18% return out of a market that's only given 10, because we don't believe that's the way to long-term wealth. So in a sense, we pre-screen clients. Our clients, we pick them up usually in their 50s. And the goal of kind of making a runway to retirement is a lot of creative tax planning strategies, which we find we're kind of unique in. And then also just the size of client to build a sustainable retirement income. So it's generally not the clients that need, hopefully, at that stage of life to get the 18% returns. And it's more about risk mitigation. And we're transparent. We try to give people that outline. And if they don't fit the mold, we're big enough where we need to cater to that person and be 100% for the client that we've been working with the most. So everybody has some clients that are going to need a little bit more handholding. And we usually find after the first couple of years, there's a level of trust built and they understand the direction we're going. So
do you ever get people that come in and they want to tell you how to invest?
Yeah. And we just say no. We do a model portfolio approach, which I think is one unique thing where if we weren't doing it this ETF style, we'd be running individual stocks and individual bonds. So our alternative wouldn't be mutual funds in our current state. So with that, the problem I find with the individual approach is you have to do a customized portfolio for every client. You cannot scale. You cannot do one thing for a bunch of people. And by doing the model approach, all of our clients are subscribed to one of the models and it really streamlines our trading and our strategy process and kind of brings everything all together. So we present our model portfolios, we present how we assess things moving forward, we present our background, and if people want to chase the unicorns, they can do that on their own dime, and that's just not something we would cater to. So
how much of your time is spent managing wholesalers, the bombardment of fund issuer pushes? I mean, how many calls in a given day would you say that you get from fund companies?
Our office manager is great at screening. Like I said before, you got to say no in this business a lot, unfortunately, I think, to be good. But we probably get 6 to 8 phone calls a day, every day. I mean, there's a new ETF being built every minute, it feels like nowadays. I think I read there's 40 new factors being invented every year right now. So everybody's trying to flood into this market because it's showing that there's trends nowadays. But I would say there's a couple of providers out there, you guys would be included, that are hiring CFAs instead of salespeople. And it's a funny thing, knowing all the CFAs in Michigan, there's not many salespeople in that group. You're a little unique if you're on that side of things and being able to get through that test. But you guys, Invesco, Nuveen, iShares, those are the organizations that have actually hired what I consider to be smart analysts that can actually add value to us. But a lot of other stuff, unfortunately, there's room for improvement, I'd say. So we try not to get involved in too much of the wholesaler meeting. So
we'll move the needle. Let's say somebody has, I've got a single basis point, low vol ETF, something that's very appropriate for your models, meets all your criteria. You're looking for people that they themselves are investment people. They themselves are coming from that expertise. They could speak that language. They could demonstrate to you, answer the hard questions, as opposed to being like, hey, buddy, let me take you golfing.
Yeah. A big thing in being independent, which we hang our hat on, is just conflict of interest and independence. We don't get paid from any internal costs from our investments that we utilize. And it's a big selling point compared to, say, the Merrill Lynches and Ameriprises and other things out there. So we want to keep our integrity. We want to uphold the fiduciary duty. And with that, that's where I feel like all that type of stuff doesn't suit this business. So
this is a constant theme that we hear from younger advisors, where they're looking for subject matter experts that could provide either value-added technology, value-added models, or value-added content, thought yep. leadership that can help you and help you assess the economy and the market and better understand and present the products, as opposed to a surrogate friend to buy you a stake.
Absolutely. And opening doors too, meeting the people at S&P 500 indices. I was introduced to them through a wholesaler. And so it's just the people that are understanding the industry and are excited and passionate about this stuff, they're going to share the right things with you. And it's not just going to be about dinners and such. So
let's talk about regulation. So in my past life, I was at the New York Stock Exchange, and ton of ETF listing rules and issuers coming in. They want to do this and that. They want to be creative and try to work around the rules. And you have to know the rules. And I think there's a real line of delineation between the people who are in compliance or legal in our business that will say no if there's some gray area and they're not sure. It's easier for them to say no. There's less liability on them. The problem goes away. It's just the easiest thing to say no. It's a lot harder to say yes, to say, well, the rules are such and such, and this is okay, but the speed limit's 65, so you're going to be driving 64, as opposed to saying, well, the speed limit's 65, I'd feel a little more comfortable if you kept it under 50, which I think is a problem in our industry. A lot of compliance people take that view. And so I've kind of expressed a little frustration with the industry where we're so overregulated in some wonderful ways where it's very hard to be a bad actor. You still can, and some people are, but it is very hard to be a bad actor at this point in this industry. But it's also hard to be a good actor. And it's also hard if you're just trying to educate out. Like, you can't go online and just say, hey, I believe in low vol. It's a good way to invest. Whether or not you're my client, these are my findings, this is my research, and this is why I believe that. You can't do that. That's investment advice. And you have to say, by the way, this is not investment advice, sure. Even though it is.
This is not investment advice. So
exactly. I'm pretty sure we have that in the end notes, or if not, we'll add it. Nothing here is investment advice. And while you should listen to everything Sam says, you should never listen to anything Phil says. What's your take on the state of regulation in the industry?
I kind of echo a lot what you're saying. I mean, I think it comes back to what I was talking about earlier, is just the barrier of entry is a little low. And so it attracts all these salesmen who do unscrupulous things. And then the SEC's response to that is more regulation that doesn't fit the bill. And so I think there's room for a fiduciary duty. I would vote for it, even though it could potentially make my life a little bit more difficult. But in having the experience of starting a practice from scratch, just pounding the pavement to get everything, I have to wear the hat of CEO, CIO, CCO, so compliance officer. And that is putting me as a disadvantage to a bigger firm that can farm that out to somebody to solely dedicate to that. So it's hard. And then what you're doing essentially with the regulation is only having big firms to choose from. And I think for the most healthy market, it would be good to have a system where small firms have an easier path as well too. It comes back down in my eyes to that fiduciary duty. If you're a lawyer or if you're a doctor, you got the Hippocratic Oath. And if you violate that and lose your license, that's medical school that you're throwing away, law school and the bar exam that you're throwing away. And again, if all it takes is the Series 7, which I only studied for 4 weeks for and passed, there's just not enough for the advisor to lose to not encourage them to do the things out there. So I would rather encourage good behavior than regulation. And that's where I think they're maybe a little bit behind.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's exactly it. You want to encourage good behavior. And right now the rules are such that they really disincentivize in a lot of the ways good behavior as well as the bad behavior. I mean, look, I think regulation on a surface that accomplishes what it sets out to is a good thing. I mean, nobody wants to see widows and orphans getting ripped off. Nobody wants to see people misrepresenting funds or putting people in bad funds or finding hidden ways to charge fees. Nobody wants to see that. You don't, I don't. I think it's bad for the whole industry. One person gets away with it, it gives everyone a black eye. We've seen that in the ETF industry with some unscrupulous behavior, and it's terrible for everyone. So not anti-regulation, but let's be smart about it. Let's do things that actually accomplish a goal of providing clients with the framework and the services that they can benefit from and that they can build their life and their savings on.
Yep, I agree.
So Sam, before we close out, you are in the suburbs of Detroit, but I know you're coming down increasingly to the city, and it was great to see you at the opening of Detroit Vineyards a few weeks ago. Thanks for coming out. Have you always been coming down to Detroit? Is that something that you've seen change over your time here?
I've always enjoyed being around a big city, but I haven't felt like it's warranted as much time as it takes now. I mean, the downtown's just awesome. They still got room to grow. There's still things that need to get done, but 8 years ago, me and my wife would probably eat dinner at Birmingham or Troy most often, and now it's only Detroit. I mean, and I grew up in Ann Arbor, so I was there for 23 years, and Ann Arbor's got a great scene going too. But I've come to the realization that the food in Detroit is way better than Ann Arbor nowadays as well. So just little things like that where it's the place to be if you live in this area today. It's just felt completely different than just short a time ago. So
it's so much fun down here. If anyone's listening, if you're able to stop by Detroit, look Sam up, look me up. If you're a young chef or a young restaurateur and you want to get started, it's very challenging to do so in New York or San Francisco and Chicago. It's just prohibitively expensive. If you're an artist, we're seeing art galleries pop up. People are coming now to Detroit because they can and because there's a scene and an energy and it's still affordable. And it's just such an exciting thing to be a part of.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's a great place. And also from a business perspective, rents are cheap. Talent is here. Talking about an incubator to be able to build a big business, there's no way that I could build the business that I'm building today in New York or Boston in my eyes. So,
Sam, where can people learn more about SGH?
Our website is sghwm.com. We have all our information on there. I'm also on LinkedIn quite a bit, so you can see all of our recent news clippings and other things as well there. That's a huge source for us today as well, too.
Well, thanks for coming on. Great to see you. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please subscribe. Please give us a good rating, and we'll be back on next week.
Thanks for joining us this week on the ETF Experience Podcast. Be sure to visit us at exponentialetfs.com to join the conversation and view our show notes. If you love this episode of the ETF Experience, head over to Apple Podcasts to subscribe, rate, and to leave a review. As always, thanks for listening and see you next week.
This Exponential Exceptional podcast is published and provided for informational and entertainment purposes only. All opinions expressed by the show participants are solely their current opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Exponential ETFs. None of the information constitutes a recommendation that any particular security, portfolio of securities, transaction, or investment strategy is suitable for any specific person.